This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2009 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Barsmith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
Welcome everyone to this, the ultimate episode in this year's Festival of Ideas. My name is Robert Fidian and I'm chair of the festival, and thank you very much for coming. It's been a wonderful couple of days. And here we're here to talk about shame, which I think in some ways is the pointy end of the free speech debate that has been one of the threads through the festival. And we have some fine speakers whom I'll introduce individually before they speak. Some of us will stand, some of us will sit, so you'll just have to get used to the idea of the variation. But by way of introduction, I think I'll indulge myself momentarily. I have an interest in satire. That's where I come from in this debate. So shaming people who are shameless is something I think is certainly appealing. And I hope to discover in the course of the afternoon that it's also morally justifiable. But I'm not sure I'm going to get away with that one. And what we do when we organise a festival with all these panel sessions is come up with a title, and then we try and write a couple of hundred words to give to the speakers. And I've been doing this now for a decade, trying to write these couple of hundred word session notes, I call them. And it's a very odd writing experience, because there you are on topics usually where I know very little, writing to people who know an awful lot. So what I try and do is come up with it's not that difficult, actually, in a way, come up with an idiot's view of the topic and ask the questions that I think that I think people will have. So this is what I wrote about this one. You're disgusting, shaming mechanisms in different cultures. The 18th century poet Alexander Pope was on a roll, proclaiming his destiny as the effective opposition to the corruption of his day. The day was 1738. Yes, I am proud, I must be proud to see men not afraid of God, afraid of me, safe from the bar, the pulpit and the throne, yet touched and shamed by ridicule alone. It's exhilarating, but is it true? Was Walpole, the first British Prime Minister, and his regime really as bad as Pope says? Do we need shaming vigilantes like Pope, or perhaps like the Chaser Gang these days, in public life? Wouldn't sober and charitable debate be a better path to take? Now, disgust, I understand, is a fundamental human emotion that goes back to the need to know to avoid putrid food. Armed with magnetic resonance imaging scanners, modern neuroscience has shown that moral disgust uses very much the same cerebral wiring as our visceral disgust. In other words, what happens in the brain seems to be very similar if you find something ethically disgusting to if you're confronted with some off meat. Whether this means anything is something we can debate. It should come as no surprise, however, that satire and other shaming mechanisms go back as far as human cultures and we can see. So I then encourage the speakers to tell story of how shame works for good and ill in your experience. My own inclination is to believe that a relatively free rein for expressions of disgust is one of the crucial fail-safe mechanisms for a free and liberal society. But you may see it differently, is how I phrase it. So the basic question is whether shaming is something we should leave off, like violence, as civilization becomes more ethically sophisticated. After all, it's designed to be destructive. Does that mean it is primitive? Or are corruption and shamelessness such permanent features of human culture that it will always remain a necessary and peculiarly satisfying evil? So, Londa Schiebinger, Catherine Gelber, Shakira Hussain and Raymond Gaita are going to talk about this. And first up, we have Londa Schiebinger. From the University of... Stanford University, not the University of Stanford. She's the Hines Professor of History. She's the Feinberg Director of the Clayman Institute for Gender Research. She's a historian of science and a historian of women's participation in science. She's interested in the structure of scientific institutions, the gendering of human knowledge. The breadth of her knowledge is, I think, very well represented by the titles of her books, which are in the program, but I think they bear reading out. The Mind Has No Sex, Women in the Origins of Modern Science, Nature's Body, Gender in the Making of Modern Science, Has Feminism Changed Science, and Plants and Empire, Colonial Bioprospecting in the Atlantic World, which is about the 18th century. It's about the period when science became a thing, became a sort of separate discipline. So, Vonda, speak first.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure being here in Adelaide and addressing such wonderful audiences. I suppose I should try to shame you in some way for coming, but I don't think I will. Now, to my mind, shaming simply does not work in society. One man's shame is another woman's glory, and vice versa. Societies, I would think, should be governed by sober and charitable debate. But sometimes even more is needed, such as hard-gained evidence, legislative action, and this is how human society should be governed. So I would like to take our example from the women's struggle to be in the professions, to be university professors, to be involved in the life of the mind, to shape human life through research, discovering new ideas and new ways of living. And I chose this subject because shaming is often used in association with issues surrounding gender and ethnic equality. And if you think about it, we often try to shame people into new behavior, and this is not something that we should do. For hundreds of years, intellectual women wrote treatises using the full range of human rhetoric, and most likely they included shaming. They used this rhetoric to argue for their rights, to enter university, to have the right to vote, to enter the professions of being a doctor or a lawyer. Think, for example, of Mary Wollstonecraft having her stabs at Jacques Rousseau, or François Poulain de la Barre, both fabulous rhetoricians, but this did nothing. This kind of rhetoric they used did very little to move women ahead. So what does work in moving ahead equality for women? I'm often asked why women do relatively well in U.S. universities. We're about 20% of the senior professors. I don't know what they are here in Australia. So 20% isn't very many. I'm talking about the very senior professors. But it's quite good compared to a number of European countries, such as Germany, the Netherlands, and Sweden, who have only 10%. So shaming certainly did not get us there. What got us there was civil legislation. In the 1960s and 70s, the U.S. government passed the Equal Opportunity Act and the Equal Pay Act. They gave women, or anyone for that matter, the right to sue. And in the 1990s, academic women brought class action suits against universities. They banded together to argue for their rights. Now, women don't have to do that any longer because the universities are mostly self-regulating in attempting to avoid suits. Now, the second thing that works is not shaming, but factual evidence, data, the facts in black and white. People used not to believe that women were particularly underrepresented in academic life. This had to be demonstrated. In the United States, two very important things happened. In the 1970s, our National Science Foundation began gathering statistics on the composition of the scientific workforce. And one can now chart how many women got their PhD and then how many women should be represented in a particular field. If only 20% of women get PhDs in physics, say, they shouldn't be 50% of the physicists in the world. That would be kind of a problem. So if fewer, but the problem is if fewer go into the profession than are prepared for it, then women can bring suit. And this is important. Our U.S. national academies just last month released a heavy report discussing the issues whether or not women are represented in the proper numbers, and their findings were such that it got all the major universities off the hook, including Stanford University. Universities were in danger of losing their federal funding, their support for scientific research, if they were not, in fact, hiring and promoting women at the right percentage. Now, there was a second development that really rocked the scientific world having to do with women's equality in 1999, and that was that all the women scientists at MIT got together. There were about 11 of them, not many. MIT is one of those technical universities. And they got together, and they had the feeling that they did not have as many university resources as their male counterparts, but you can't argue with the feeling. You can't bring forward issues with the feeling. So they got out their measure sticks, and they measured their lab space. And they found that, in fact, they as a group, had less lab space than the men as a group. And this really impressed people. It's scientific. It's a scientific method. Now, in fact, I think it's very important not to shame people, especially in relationship to issues having to do with equality. This is not the way that you change minds and hearts. People who feel shamed harden themselves and they dig in their heels. Now, for example, in the United States now, we often, in industry and in universities, in public institutions, we teach people about subtle gender bias. Subtle gender bias is when you are intending to treat people equally, but in fact you're not even aware that you're treating women or people of underrepresented minorities differently. Now, it's very hard to convey this information to people who think they are not discriminating. But if you use a shaming, early on what we did is we gathered people in rooms, and a trainer would sit them down and say, "Now you are very, very bad. You are discriminating against various people." But this didn't work at all. There was a huge backlash. So what we are doing now, one of my colleagues at Stanford, Hannah Valentine, who is a famous cardiologist, has taken this issue on in the medical school, and she has received grants from the National Institutes of Health to do this. And instead of sitting her colleagues down and saying, "Oh, you know, you have some really peculiar ideas about women," and she herself is African American, "and about people from different ethnic backgrounds," she's having a research project. She's involving her colleagues in researching this issue. And professors are used to being involved in research, and they're quite on board. So you get the picture. Key social issues need to be resolved through careful debate, legislative action, and backed by evidence. So much for public issues. We see now how to, I think, create equality in the public sphere, but what about the private domestic sphere? Legislation does not creep into the home, perhaps as far as we would like it to. What about housework and childcare and the division of domestic labor? Okay, well, here's the problem. In the U.S., and I would guess that this is also true in Australia, women do about twice as much domestic labor. These are professional women, women with full-time jobs, do twice as much domestic labor as men. So women professors who are married with children do about 31 hours of domestic work per week, and fathers in the same position do about 15 hours. And that's up from 5 hours in the 1960s. So I guess we should be really proud, you know, urge on the men in this. Now, to enjoy the life of the mind, even to attend this festival, someone has to be taking care of the kids. Someone has to have laundered all the clean clothes that you're wearing. Someone has to have gathered the food, purchased the food, and prepared it that we all ate before we came. So I think there is a very close relationship between the life of the mind and the life of the belly. Now, women have engaged in different strategies to try to get their partners to step up to the plate. And now, my data comes from heterosexual couples. We in a study that we did on housework in how much housework professors did, we included same-sex couples, but we didn't have enough to make it statistically something that we could talk about. But women have used different strategies to get their partners to step up to the plate. We've tried telling men that they're missing out on great things, the chance to bond with the domestic sphere, to get all those warm and tingling feelings from smelling fresh and warm laundry. I don't know, I sort of like taking it out of the dryer and embracing it. But we've also tried shaming men. You know, we say, honey, you're not doing your share, let's be equals. Now, I've been trying to shame the same man for 30 years. Let me tell you, shaming does not work because there are powerful forces at work, more powerful than shaming, and that is socialization. It's also social norms. One way you can tell how much housework a particular man is going to do is how much his friends do, because we all fit into our social group. Now, what works, however, is outsourcing. And this is taking a private problem and moving it from the private sphere into the public sphere where it can be better regulated. Now, outsourcing simply means hiring someone else to clean your home or taking your clothes to the dry cleaners or going out for dinner or ordering in. In a recent study that I directed showed that scientists, men and women, are more productive. That is to say, they have more great scientific ideas, they publish more papers, if they hand over their housework to other people. So I think this is something that governments and universities should pay attention to, because we, in fact, don't have enough scientists right now. In the U.S., we're always trying to recruit more. We're trying to get women to become scientists because we need to tap into that pool of talent. So this is an important issue that I think societies need to solve. If this is the case, if outsourcing solves some of the problems, and it won't solve all of the problems, because even if you're hiring out your work, someone has to manage that process of hiring things out. But if it's the case that outsourcing solves part of the problem, then there's no reason why we can't improve things. Governments and institutions can provide resources to create a level playing field in the home. And this is just, I mean, we're familiar already with this approach because our governments, in fact, step into the private sphere in many instances. We all have health care. Governments and institutions help us afford our health care. Very often there are child care schemes and these sorts of things. And so I think that institutions need to look more deeply into how to support aspects of private life that can support women's careers and our goals as a society. Now, my specific proposal is that government and institutions provide a bundle of flexible benefits that can be used for any aspect of the private side of life that saves times and hence enhances productivity. So I would conclude then that disgust or shaming and the like will get us nowhere. I think it's something that we can and should live without. Thank you.
Thank you, Londa. Now we turn to Raymond Gaita, who is perhaps the foremost public philosopher in Australia. He's Professor of Moral Philosophy at King's College, University of London, and at the Australian Catholic University. And he addresses a wide audience with a great philosophical seriousness. He treats us with the respect that suggests that we can, in fact, work our way through quite complicated ideas if we just pay a bit of attention. The books of his that I know a little and admire a lot are Romulus, My Father, and A Common Humanity, Thinking About Love, Truth and Justice. And his commitment to absolute values, absolute human values, is apparent in all his work, and I imagine will be apparent in the next 10 minutes or so. Raymond.
Thank you for those kind. I don't really need this, do I? Thank you for those kind remarks. Well, I want to sketch some of the landscape and some of the landmarks in the landscape, conceptual landscape of morality's relation to shame. Well, shame has many facets, from, of course, involuntary to voluntary behaviour. We can be ashamed of how we look or for what we've done, or rather, I'd prefer to say, in the case of shame, for what's been revealed about us through what we've done. And we can be ashamed about what, through no fault of our own, we've become caught up in the crimes of our political ancestors, for example. And in this connection, it's important to distinguish shame from guilt. My cowardice might lead me, for example, to betray somebody. I'm guilty for the betrayal and remorseful for it, but ashamed of the coward and much else that might have been revealed about me. That's not a hard and fast distinction, but it'll do for the moment. I don't know much about the practices of shaming in various cultures, but I'll say a little about a distinction that's often drawn between shame and guilt cultures, as that applies to ancient Greece and post-Christian societies. Aristotle, I'll say a little bit about, he was a man for whom nobility and honour were the focal concepts in his way of looking at ethical matters. And wherever you get honour as a focal concept, then you get shame as an important concept too. Aristotle believed that a good human life was lived in the enjoyment of the deserved esteem of one's peers. He believed that to be not merely one of life's good, but its chief good. And that's evident if we read him, unprejudiced by a conception of morality deeply influenced by Christianity. The distance between his understanding of the virtues, which he believed to be constitutive of a well-lived and flourishing human life, and ours, is well brought out in one of his remarks on friendship. He considers whether it's the highest expression of friendship to lay down your life for a friend, and rejects that idea in favour of the thought that it's finer to allow your friend to lay down his life for you, because in that case, all you get is life, whereas she gets a shiny and glorious deed. He's quite serious about this, isn't he? Just think of Achilles, for example. The unashamed enjoyment of our noble deeds, and if we're lucky, of a life blessed with many such deeds, is alien to that part of our souls which is influenced by a Christian understanding, not of nobility or honour, but of goodness, or rather of a conception in which goodness rather than nobility or honour is the focal concept. It's part of our souls which finds expression in the story of St. Jerome, who called to an appointment with Jesus, made himself late by stopping to help a stranger free his cart from the mud in which it had sunk. The point of the story, of course, is that that was his appointment with Jesus. Goodness, as we understand it, can't be achieved by directly pursuing it. The surest way of ensuring that our deeds are not good is by doing them for the sake of being good or doing good. And that observation is commonplace, it seems to me, for a post-Christian sort of culture. And the conception of virtue and its place in human life, which I've claimed is Aristotle's, is that it's of the essence of virtue that appear, be manifest, to those who are worthy to judge and to honour it. That doesn't mean that we may act for the appearance rather than the reality of the virtue, but rather that its reality as a virtue, whose exercise is partly constitutive of good human life, is that it illuminate that life as one deserving of public honour. Is by no means a base conception of virtue. It expresses the uncoy enjoyment of a quite uncorrupt worldliness in which the public expression of the esteem of our peers and of our enjoyment of it is not only permissible, but to be pursued as a constitutive of the good life. Justifiably to be shamed on many occasions, that would obviously destroy that good life. Bernard Williams, who wrote a fine book called Shame and Necessity, adapted the Eastern European joke that says that communism was the longest road between capitalism and capitalism. He adapts that to read that Christianity was the longest road between paganism and paganism. He thought that with the effective collapse of Christianity as a force to be reckoned with in moral thinking, we should return to the ancient Greeks for guidance, not so much about what to do, but about how to conceive the way that morality matters to us. the kind of place that it should have in our lives. We would then, he reckons, place less emphasis than we have done on the difference between shame and guilt. And together with a colleague, Richard Vollheim, who also wrote a fine book called The Thread of Life, Vollheim was deeply influenced by Kleinian psychoanalysis, he attacks, together with Vollheim, a guilt-centred morality with a Kantian emphasis on obligations that fall upon a rather thin and characterless moral agent. They hope to persuade us from allegiance to a sense of morality as being ubiquitous and overriding, which allows for no other value seriously to compete with moral value, and which is marked by a psychologically destructive preoccupation with a sense of guilt that's radically distinguished from shame. They believe that a critical philosophy, which is historically informed and supported by a sophisticated moral psychology, itself probably deepened by evolutionary theory, will locate the nature of the value that we call moral, or as much as they think can be retrieved from the distortions of religion, will place that firmly in the natural conditions of human life. And Vollheim argued that morality, morality narrowly conceived, as he sometimes put it, is structured by the largely alien and persecutory voice of the superego, and is thus oriented towards guilt and preoccupied with what to do rather than with what one should be. And he argues that morality inherits from the superego certain baneful features which are intrinsic to it, and that to move beyond them we should think of shame as the prime sentiment of evolved morality, of morality beyond the superego. Well, there are some thoughts that place about the role of shame in the constitution of our ways of seeing the ethical. I don't, in fact, agree with them, but that doesn't matter. It takes me to what I want to say about shaming as a punitive sort of institution, which I take that to be expressive, a very unsavoury disposition that seems to be right at the heart of our idea of morality, to moralising in the pejorative, or judgmentalism in the pejorative sense of that term. And I think we have that because at least since Aristotle, an important part of our Western tradition has given us a conception of morality that's both moralistic and legalistic. And it does this by binding conceptually the conditions under which one can justifiably apply moral concepts to someone's character or behaviour to the conditions under which one can praise or blame them for what they've done or made of themselves. And if you see morality like that, as so many people do, then of course you'll think that to judge someone's behaviour severely just is, amongst other things, to blame them, which often goes hand in hand with a preparedness to point fingers and to turn one's back on them. Well, many people find incoherent the idea that one could be morally severe without being judgmental. And that often shows itself when people argue over the behaviour of criminals who have had appalling backgrounds, where it seems almost impossible to see in them a place where goodness could grow, because it's hard to see in those lives where the person who's lived that life could even have glimpsed goodness. And on the one hand, we have those who feel that they can't in themselves find in themselves a place from which to blame such criminals. Perhaps these people say, "There, but for the grace of God go I." And they often believe that they must therefore withhold moral descriptions of what the criminals have done. And on the other hand, there are those who feel strongly that moral descriptions do apply, even in such cases, to the criminal's behaviour, and they feel, therefore, that they're obliged to blame. And both sides to this dispute, those who refuse to apply moral descriptions, they say, "There, for the grace of God go I," and those who insist on it, saying, "Not everybody who grows up like that behaves like that, etc." Both of them share this assumption. The moral descriptions justifiably apply only when those to whom they apply are culpable, and often thereby they commit themselves to irresolvably contentious theories about freedom of the will. Well, to see someone's behaviour in a morally severe light does not entail, I believe, that one must blame them for what they do. Primarily, to hold someone responsible means to hold them, to fix them, in a lucid response to the moral significance of what they did. It means that they and we must not evade that significance, but it does not necessarily mean that we find fault with them, that we should accuse them, or that we judge them to be proper objects of blame. Parents sometimes enable their children to see and prevent them from evading the consequences of seeing the terrible wrong they've done by the quality of their severe pity and sorrow for the wrongdoers those children became. Well, that conception of responsibility, that is to be, that I've just sketched, that is to be responsible, is essentially to be lucidly responsive to the moral significance of what one has done, or sometimes simply become caught up in, enables us to see more clearly something about the nature of collective responsibility. And I've written quite a bit about this. And that is that it needn't be collective guilt. The concept of shame might help. In Australia, reconciliation is the name that was given to the acknowledgement that past and present injustices against the Aboriginal peoples generated for the non-Aboriginal inhabitants a sense of collective responsibility for the wrongs committed by their political ancestors. Reconciliation, by the way, was never a good name because it implied, amongst other things, that non-Aboriginal Australians had a legitimate complaint against the Aborigines. Well, as one would expect, there's been disagreement about the nature and extent of collective responsibility. Generally, however, those who welcomed the diverse movements that came together under the head of reconciliation agreed that if contemporary Australians could speak intelligibly of what we did when we pioneered the land or fought at Gallipoli, then appealing to that same sense of collective agency, they could say, as Paul Keating did at Redfern, of what we did when we dispossessed the Aboriginal peoples of their land or took their children from their mothers. The collective responsibility expressed in Keating's we is not collective guilt. John Howard was right to say that one should feel guilty only for what one has done, or in certain circumstances, for what one failed to do. Shame rather than guilt is the natural counterpart to the pride he so often expressed for Australia. And I've elaborated on the relevance of that distinction to a sense of collective responsibilities in many of my writings, so I won't go on about it here, except to say that shame for what one's country has done depends on a relation to it that's different from, and in many respects deeper than, citizenship. Oversimplifying a little, I'll call it an identity-forming relationship that makes Keating's we one of national fellowship, rather than merely one that enumerates membership of a class. That identity-forming relation takes time to develop, and beyond the respect, loyalty, obligation, and gratitude to a newly naturalised immigrant that a newly naturalised immigrant might feel, requires something like love. And for that reason, the disillusion with national other institutions has driven some people, Peter Sutton, for example, in his recently acclaimed book, The Politics of Suffering, to argue that reconciliation is best expressed between individuals rather than by the actions of national institutions. And that, I think, is a mistake. The work of those institutions will count for nothing, of course, unless there's also friendship and sometimes love between Aborigines and non-Aborigines, considered merely as individual human beings. Only as an Australian, however, whose identity has to some extent been shaped by being Australian, by attachments to this country, can I feel ashamed of what was done by my political ancestors. And only as an Australian, rather than a Victorian, can I feel rightly ashamed of what was done in other parts of the country. It's therefore also mistaken to say, as Sutton argues in that same book, that because all the states have apologised, there was no need ever for a national apology. In whatever way one finally unpacks morally and conceptually all that's contained in Keating's we, its use implies we can be called upon to be responsive to the moral character of what we've been caught up in, though we played no causal part in it. And it's true of pride, it's true of shame. The former can decline into jingoism, that is, pride can decline into jingoism, and the latter, shame, into morbid self-abasement. But neither decline is necessary. People who, and desire, I would say, lucidly to love one's country without shame, to acknowledge shame when it's necessary to do so, is the only thing that can prevent love of country from degenerating into jingoism. And it's also necessary, I think, if we're to avoid a jingoistic conception of the common good or the national interest. Finally, just a couple of words about shaming now as a public institution, a punitive institution. People who have become the victims of crimes, and this includes political crimes, hunger for justice to be done. And that, I believe, often requires the prosecution of those who committed the crimes. Many people who originally supported the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa say that it did not satisfy that desire for justice, and they say that that unsatisfactory situation was compounded by the fact that no more truth and no more reconciliation were achieved than would have been the case had there been trials. Reports from Germany suggest the same in regard to Germany's decision not to prosecute Stasi criminals. A different story might emerge from the former Czechoslovakia. But if justice is to be done to the victims of crimes, it is at least necessary to identify the perpetrators of those crimes and to give the right name to those crimes. Shaming, however, as a punitive institution is different altogether. Justice requires, I believe, what Kant thought to be the acknowledgement of the inalienable dignity that's possessed by every human being and to which every human being owes unconditional respect. Shaming, to the contrary, as a punitive institution, aims at degradation and humiliation, not at a humbled recognition of what one has done. It's the expression of that unsavory moralistic dimension of morality that I spoke about earlier. Simone Weil once made the remark that human beings have the same carnal nature as animals. When a hen is sick and vulnerable, the others rush to peck it.
Okay, thank you, Ray. My appetite for satire is looking pretty crook. I hope we don't have a scoreboard up there, but so far it seems that the desire to shame is useless, patriarchal and moralising. We'll see how we go. Shakira Hussain is from ANU is as interesting as her coyly modest biography in the program suggests. The biography itself illustrates what a brilliant public writer and thinker she is on Islam, gender and multiculturalism. These are crucial issues for us as a society and in the world, and they so quickly degenerate into what I like to call dinosaur rhetoric, where people just talk their line of argument almost in isolation. They shout it and get the opposite response from the other side. That is very clearly not what Shakira does. Shakira's perspective is often humorous, always humanly sensitive, and the sort of thing we need to have more of to get beyond those battlements. Shakira.
Thanks. You've heard of people who can't walk and chew gum at the same time. I can't stand up and think at the same time, so I'm not following my colleagues to the podium. Inshallah, I can sit and think at the same time and it won't be too shaming an experience. In the wake of the Satanic Verses affair and the Danish cartoons, the Muslim capacity for taking offence has been positioned as a threat to our society, our way of life, and in particular to our free speech. Muslims are seen as trying to silence voices that might cause offence to them, that might cause offence to their religious sensibilities. And it's often been alleged that newspaper editors, publishers, and others who are gatekeepers of our culture are exercising a form of self-censorship rather than risk causing offence to Muslims and ending up in hiding with Salman Rushdie, who wouldn't make a very easy flatmate from everything I've heard. As Rushdie himself says, Satanic Verses is a very long book and you'd have to go to quite a lot of work in order to be offended by it. And it's offensive to one person or another from start to finish, but there's plenty of offence within Satanic Verses to spread around, quite a lot of offence to Margaret Thatcher, as I recall, to Sikh terrorists, to lots of targets besides Islam. Satanic Verses I defend as being a worthy artistic expression, whether it's offensive or not. The Danish cartoons, I'm less willing to defend on those grounds. I'm willing to defend the right to publish, but I'm not willing to defend them as being really worth the effort. And it's worth repeating the background to the Danish cartoons because that got lost in all the fracas. And that background is that the editor of a, as I understand it, quite right-wing Danish newspaper heard that a publisher was having trouble getting an illustrator for a children's book about the life of the prophet because all the artists he approached had knew that it was offensive to Muslims to draw, or to many Muslims, not all, to draw a pictorial representation of, well, people in general and the prophet in particular. And the newspaper thought that was a dreadful example of a publisher bowing to Muslim demands. And so he commissioned a series of cartoons in which the prophet would be drawn, would be represented, knowing full well that as far as some Muslims, many Muslims were concerned, this was an act of blasphemy. So it was an act whose entire purpose was to give offence to Muslims in particular, who in Denmark, of course, are a marginalised minority group, not a powerful entity. And, well, he got a bit more offence than he bargained on, because it wasn't only Muslims in Denmark who responded. As others have chronicled at great length, that this issue was taken up by Muslims in other countries, Muslims where Muslims are not a marginalised minority, Muslims where Muslims were the majority, were in power, were in state, in charge of the state. And there was a general Muslim boycott of Danish feta cheese, as I recall, and other such products that were associated with this offensive act. And people were killed in these demonstrations, and Danish embassies, any institution that was seen as being associated with Denmark around the world, came under, you know, quite violent attack. And in the wake of this, on the one hand, expression of the cartoons was seen as free speech. And there was a lot of criticism of newspapers in Australia and elsewhere for not reproducing the cartoons, for giving way to Muslim demands, for being silenced. On the other hand, expressions of Muslim offence, that wasn't seen as free speech, that was seen as incitement. That was seen as somehow giving support to the violent acts, the indefensibly violent acts that were being committed in the wake of the cartoon publication. If you're willing to defend the right to offend, then you have to also defend the right to be offended and to express it peacefully. And part of free expression is listening to the offended people as well as giving offence. And while I would defend the right to give offence also, I'd say that it's not productive to give offence merely for the sake of proving that you can do so. To give offence merely to, you know, to show that you are entitled to be offensive. So that's one incident that came to mind when I saw the title of this session. Another is the quite ritualistic means by which powerless people are shamed in order to impose a form of discipline. And I can think of two examples of this. And one is the ritualistic shaming of women, women of all religions, incidentally, who are seen to have gone astray in South Asia, by stripping them naked and walking them through the streets. That's a way of showing women that they've been bad, that they've transgressed in some ways, that they've challenged the given social order in ways that are unacceptable, to strip them, to leave them with no shelter at all. But I also thought of Muslim women in Australia who are stripped not naked but stripped of their headscarves. And that's an interesting form of shaming somebody because the people who are tearing off their headscarves, of course, they don't think that the sight of a woman's hair is offensive. They think that, in fact, covering a woman's hair is offensive. But they know very well that tearing off a headscarf, it will be experienced as shaming by the person to whom they're doing it. It's interpreted differently by the target than by the offender. And so that's one of the many forms of shaming that have been imposed on Muslims in the wake of 9/11. But I also thought of, besides the many, many countless times that I've opened a newspaper or turned on the television and felt offended over the last number of years by the opinions being expressed, I have also felt a fairly intense desire on occasions to be offensive. And, you know, I've given way to that. Most of what I write is very serious, long, extended, often academic articles, as Robert was saying, on gender, Islam and South Asia, which aren't, frankly, a bundle of laughs. And so while I wouldn't describe myself as a satirist and I've really only dabbled around the edges, I have used it as a form of therapy at various points, usually with the odd, you know, 300 words for crikey. I'm not going to pretend that that's done anything to change the political landscape. But, you know, writing 300 words making fun of Kesar Chad's ass, it might not exactly change the world, but it sure as hell made me feel better. I mean, the chairman of the Islamic Friendship Association has a very substantial ass, and if you're looking for an easy target, it's kind of hard to miss. And this use of offensiveness as a form of relief, as a form of therapy, I think it's quite valuable. It is not going to really, I doubt, bring about regime change. It would be nice to think that dictators, that governments, that powerful media proprietors are going to be made irrelevant, are going to be driven from their thrones of power by us poking fun at them. I'm inclined to think not. I'm inclined to think that no matter how ridiculous we make them seem, they've still got the instruments of power. When it comes right down to it, they've got the military. And laughter isn't quite so powerful. But it keeps us going. It keeps us from being entirely disheartened. Maybe that's why military dictatorships produce the best satire. Maybe that's why John Howard has been such a huge loss for the comedians of Australia. Really, I don't think the chase has ever recovered. Kevin Rudd, I'm sure, will produce some fabulous satire in good time and is already doing so, but just at the moment, we're still wrapping our heads around the loss of John Howard. And, you know, I have to say, for all I've complained about Bronwyn Bishops over the years, I felt a deep sense of disappointment to hear that she's in danger of losing her pre-selection next election. What are we going to do? Who are we going to satirise? Who are we going to laugh at when Bronwyn leaves the scene? I just felt bereft. And so I think offensiveness, it's a weapon that's usefully deployed against the powerful. Unfortunately, it's also deployed too often against the powerless. Reality TV, I think, is another good example of that. So I will continue to be offensive wherever possible. Really, as I said, sometimes it's the only thing that gets me up in the morning. It's the only thing that gets me to the computer. I can't face this pressing academic deadline, but I think I'll rattle off a few words for crikey and that'll get me in the mood. Inshallah. And I will continue to get offended by a lot of what I see being expressed in the public realm. And I will continue to express that offense. And I will defend to the death my right to be offended and my right to take offense.
Just to affirm that last point, my colleague Hayden Manning and I have for the last several elections followed the shape of the election campaign by reviewing all the political cartoons. We call this a research project. And we get quite serious publications out of it. And why I'm saying this is to affirm that point about taking offence as a sort of therapy. In 2001, every cartoonist that we saw in Australia, with the partial exception of the cartoonist in the West Australian, was outraged by the Howard government's approach to asylum seekers. Did cartoon after cartoon showing Howard and Ruddock as monsters and Beazley as an equivocator. So far as I can tell, that had no impact on the election result in 2001. It didn't change votes. I think it was wonderfully therapeutic for those of us who thought it was a monstrous activity. On the other hand, perhaps we just laughed and didn't do enough to change things. Anyway, I'm talking too much. Now, Catherine Gelber, one of the rising stars of Australian political science. Catherine's doing crucial work at the University of New South Wales on hate speech. It's important, and those of you who were at her Mitchell oration will understand this, that Catherine is not interested in muzzling free speech. She wants robust free speech in this nation, but she also wants to find the criteria by which it doesn't become simply destructive. So the questions of public shaming therefore seem to me to be right at the pointy end of what turns from free speech into hate speech. Catherine.
Thank you. Speech is powerful. Speech does things. In traditional libertarian arguments about why speech is essential and why freedom of speech is essential, the argument tends to be assumed, if not made explicit, that speech is just an expression of opinion. All you're doing is saying something. And I don't want to restrict myself here to verbal words, because we all know that images, cartoons, and non-verbal means of expression can also be very expressive in that sense. So including all of those types of expression, the classic libertarian argument is it's just somebody saying what they think. And, of course, even as children, we're also taught the slogan, sticks and stones may hurt my bones, but names or words will never hurt me. I don't believe that. And I don't think that if many of us really looked carefully at what speech is and what speech can do, that we would agree with that. Speech is powerful. Speech does things in the saying of it. And because speech can do things in the saying of it, it can do good things and it can do bad things. We do things with our speech all the time. If somebody knocks on your door and you say, come in, you're not just expressing an opinion, you're giving them permission. If two people stand in front of a celebrant and some witnesses, and in Australia, if they're a man and a woman, and they exchange vows and a promise and a ring, then they are considered to have entered into a legally binding contract. That contract has repercussions. In saying the words, I do, they have done something. They haven't just expressed an opinion. Now, having said that, for those words, I do, to have meant what they intended them to mean, and for them to have the force that the participants intended them to have, the conditions need to be, if you like, felicitous. They need to be the right kind of conditions. So, as I said before, in Australia, those two people have to be one man and one woman. In Australia, if two women undertake exactly the same ceremony or two men undertake exactly the same ceremony, the outcome is not at all the same, legally speaking and socially speaking and culturally speaking. So the conditions have to be right. I think that we should pay more attention to where speech does good things and to where speech does bad things. Speech can do bad things when it encourages people who are already behaving badly to continue to behave badly or to behave even worse than they were before. Speech can do bad things when it destroys one's sense of self. Speech can do bad things when it amounts to bullying. I don't necessarily think that speech is automatically bad or does bad things when it just offends people, and we've just had a brilliant example of how offensive speech can galvanise people, can make them more interested in expressing their ideas. So we need to be careful about assessing when speech is bad and when speech is good, but it is undoubtedly true that speech can do bad things. It can amount to bullying, it can destroy self-esteem, it can encourage poor behaviour. It can also do good things. just as speech is capable of doing bad things like instilling stereotypes, the seeds of stereotypes into people's minds about how certain categories of people might behave or might be prone to behave. That's another example of one of the bad things. But it can also do good things. It can enhance people's sense of self-esteem, enhance people's sense of worth. It can facilitate real communication. And I'd like us to think more about where it can do good things and where it can do bad things. If we want to think of examples of when speech can do good things in and for people's lives, particularly in the context of shaming, I think it is possible, in contrast to some of the other things we've heard today, I think it is possible for shaming as a strategy to do good things for the people who participate in that strategy. But I think for that to happen, the context has to be right, and we have to pay very careful attention to that context. So I don't support shaming across the board, in principle, as something to be used willy-nilly, as something to be used whenever we think it might be a good idea. The context within which we participate in in the kind of expression we might think of as shaming is important. The person to whom the shaming is being addressed needs to be capable of being shamed. They need to be susceptible to the sensitivities that the people undertaking that activity are trying to instill in them. Now, we can all think of people, individuals and institutions and governments, who are just incapable of being shamed. And in that instance, perhaps we might still continue the shaming if there were other conditions encourage us to do it, but we might not. So the person at whom the shaming is directed needs to be, in some sense, sensitive to what is trying to be done. The context and the method need to be constructive, not destructive, of the conditions that people require in order to develop well, in order to improve behaviour, in order to be able to communicate meaningfully with one another as human beings. The speech itself, the words or the expressions or the images that are used, need to be sensitive and need to be constructive. And there I mean that we shouldn't resort to bullying, we shouldn't resort to vilification, we shouldn't resort to destroying somebody's personality. There's a variety of literature of instances within which shaming can be and is being used. For example, with drink drivers, particularly people who've had more than one offence of drink driving, there are some experiments going on with reintegrative shaming where people who up until that point in time really have been unaware of the consequences of their drink driving might be able to be brought into a situation where they carefully and in a proper environment are made more aware, attempts are made to make those people more aware of the consequences of drink driving, sometimes fatal consequences, horrific consequences of their drink driving on the community to which they belong. It's my understanding that some elements of shaming have been used in some programs to try and address bullying in schools. Now, again, there you would have to be very, very careful about how you went about the process of conducting shaming, particularly if you were involving children whose cognitive awareness of risk and whose ability to assess risk and assess what the complicated context within which things are going on is still being developed. So care needs to be taken. But I do believe that there are those kinds of instances where shaming can be used constructively, where the context can be done in, it can be paid great attention to, where the words that are being used and the people who are participating can be carefully chosen, and very, very much attention can be paid to the context. I think shaming is infelicitous when you're addressing it in a manner that becomes vilifying, which moves beyond being offensive and moves into in creating harm. And one of the examples of that is the one I referred to a moment ago, where you instill the seeds of a negative stereotype in people's minds, particularly stereotypes about racial groups or ethnic groups or gendered groups, where people begin to think that, oh, well, maybe there is some truth to that idea after all. those kinds of things would be infelicitous. In those kind of instances, shaming, I wouldn't support shaming. I don't support the use of vilification, the use of hate speech, the use of harmful words to try and promote better behaviour. And I guess I'm talking about shaming as a mechanism for promoting better behaviour. Shaming can also be infelicitous, of course, when the person or the institution you're trying to shame demonstrates an incapacity to be shamed. And I guess another example is the international pressure on Japan to cease whaling, which is apparently having, at least to my knowledge, very little effect. There doesn't seem to be much responsiveness there to international sensitivities around the killing of whales. So I don't want to present an all-or-nothing position on the question of shaming. I do think that there are important questions to be asked and answered over shaming as an individual mechanism with individuals within a small circle, for example, with drink driving offences, and shaming at a writ large when it's directed against an institution or directed against a government. The type of shaming that goes on in, for example, political cartooning is felicitous partly in the sense that it does provide a release of tension, even though we know that the election result in 2001 was the election result that we got, and that the then government's policies on asylum seekers had appeared to have an enormous amount of support, as demonstrated in the opinion polls. Nevertheless, those of us who were horrified and who were just horrified by the Australian government's position during that time found great solace in those cartoons, and we were able to email them to each other and to show them to our students in universities and to use them in all kinds of ways to continue the dialogue in a constructive way to try and bring to bear concerns about human rights and so on. So even though the cartoons didn't change the election result, I think that they were directed against the state, they were directed against an incredibly powerful institution, which, because it is the most powerful institution in society, ought to tolerate a great deal of criticism and a great deal of vehemence when it's directed against it, and it can handle it. The state can handle it. The government can handle it. So when the object is the state or the government, then there are far fewer limits. When the object of shaming is an individual, or particularly a child, or a perpetrator of a crime who may have a personal history that needs to be taken into account, then we need to take, I think, a great deal more care. So that's what I think. I think that that shaming is potentially a powerful mechanism, both for the release of individual of tension and both the release of those creative ideas when it's directed against a powerful institution, but can be used constructively in individual situations as long as we take care and remember always that speech is very, very powerful. Thank you.
Well, this is your festival, and so we'll have as much time as we can for questions, but I have one question that follows on very directly from what you've just said, Catherine. The thing that gives me most satisfaction, and I think this chimes with Shakira, with Shakira's point as well, is the shaming of the shameless. People or institutions that should be ashamed of what they're doing. That is something I would very, very be very loath to give up as a mechanism in public debate, in free speech. And what I think it is primarily a matter of power. And I've had this discussion with students over the years discussing satire. Everything should be ridiculed, they say, but what about X? Oh, no, not that. And I think ethically the position I've come to is that the powerful may be attacked by almost whatever means you can come up with. Do any of you have, whereas the powerless should not be? Now, that's an ethical thing, it's not a formal thing, but I think it's something I believe quite strongly. Do any of you have a response to that? Is shaming the shameless still not very sad, still not efficacious, not worth doing longer?
Well, I look at the kind of satire that goes on in the United States. I'm a great fan of Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart. I'm sure you get those over here. But I think what happens with the political satire, of course I believe in free speech, and I think we should use satire to heighten people's awareness of what's going on. But what happens with the left in the United States is that we all feel better, as you were kind of suggesting earlier, and then we become ineffective. And so I really think that ridicule is too easy. I think that satire is too easy. What we need to do is, academics certainly need not to just analyze satire, but be public intellectuals, as you are encouraging people to be in this festival. And I think that we need to do much harder work. It's just too easy to shame or ridicule, be critical. I think that we need to really encourage people to take positive action and go out there and get that power.
I dispute the idea that ridicule is easy, actually. Ridicule can take a lot of hard work. Believe me.
I don't think satire or shaming aim to undermine power. They aim to deflate bogus authority. If it's just power you're at, no amount of satire will do anything. What satire does is unmask, deflate, and so on. So it depends on people making a distinction between authority and power and recognising that it's bogus in a particular case. And it seems to me very often, even though the person who's the object of satire may feel ashamed seeing a cartoon of herself or himself, But that doesn't mean the aim of this satire was to shame. It may have just been to deflate and expose and so on. I agree with Catherine that in certain kinds of contexts, to make somebody humbly acknowledge to the shame, to make someone humbly to acknowledge the shameful thing that they've done is a good thing. And indeed, insofar as I was saying those things about collective responsibility, I was trying to argue that the argument for reconciliation ought to bring Australians to awareness of the shame that they have been caught up in by being Australians and the crimes of their ancestors. So I distrusted institutionally when I do have this idea about free-floating. I mean, I believe in this theory of free-floating malice. Human beings have an enormous propensity for indignation, for pointing the finger, and so on. And so I just don't trust it. I've seen these theories about what kids should do, teachers should do, enlisting kids to do to kids who are misbehaving. I hate it. I really hate it. But I suppose it depends how whether you do have this sort of distrust of a deep human propensity to point fingers. And I think that's got nothing to do with moral seriousness. You know, I say this because some of you have probably read Romulus, My Father. He was one of the most morally serious people I knew. I described him as someone for whom nothing mattered in life, so much as to live it decently, where nothing really meant nothing. But he was never a man to point fingers. He would call you a crook or a liar or whatever, speaking that plainly and simply, and then invite you to dine with him. There was never a sense of exclusion, which I think the punitive institution of shaming intrinsically aims at. It's saying, look, come. It always involves getting people together and saying, look. I think that's very dangerous, even though I don't deny that there could be consequences. But I notice you did say you have to be very, very careful. I think we can't be careful enough.
We have people make their way to the microphone if they have any questions. And please make them questions at this stage.
Hi. One example that comes to my mind of shaming in Australian public policy is unemployment. I think unemployed people are subjected to ritual humiliation on a weekly basis or a fortnightly basis, I'm not sure, when they have to turn up in person and wait in line and hand in a form and have it signed by people, whereas other kinds of social support can be provided via the internet there's different sorts of treatment for the way that we treat unemployed people, and the argument that's usually given for this treatment is that it would dissuade people from being on unemployment benefits and that it would reduce the number of people who are unemployed. And based on the discussion today, my impression is that it would have no such effect, that the shaming rituals that are included in this kind of policy are just nasty, degrading and humiliating for vulnerable people, because unemployed people are vulnerable, with no positive effect. And so I would guess that the implications of what's been said today for public policy regarding unemployment would be that it should change and not shame people anymore, but I'd like to ask you all what you think about that.
Thank you. Who wants that one?
I agree absolutely, completely.
Yes, I do too. It's a degrading experience to have to go into a Centrelink office, and one wonders how much of that experience is designed to degrade and how much of it is just coincidental. I do believe that there are some individuals that it can depend a little bit on the person who you encounter at the counter. Some of them seem to be a little more humane and some of them seem to be a little less humane. But the problem within those institutions can be exacerbated by the bigger policy in the background. And once the concept of mutual obligation was introduced into Australian public policy in relation to unemployment benefits, that is, if we're going to give you money, you have to do something in exchange, and that was a significant shift away from the previous conception, which was if you're unemployed, then the state has a responsibility to provide you with at least enough money to survive. And then that shifted into mutual obligation. We're giving you something, so you have to do things in return. And I think those kind of big picture policy backgrounds can exacerbate that kind of degradation. We saw the same thing in the Department of Immigration during the worst years of the Tampa and refugees and asylum seeker Australian citizens themselves being locked up in detention centres and very degrading practices. And there was a background policy framework which was buttressing those kind of behaviours at the coalface. So when the policy is at its harshest, those behaviours at the coalface are unsurprising, and I agree with you, very degrading.
It seems to me that most of what's been addressed today is shame as it applies to an individual, whether it's from another individual or by an institution such as Centrelink, I guess. But what about shame that's practiced from, let's say, throughout Parliament or from the pulpit or in enculturation in education, where the majority of the population accepts it as a way, and the few that are not following suit, the few that are having the shame addressed, are the only ones that are having it projected to them, but the rest of the group fully accepts and agrees. Shame comes from the enculturation that we live with all the time. How do we get around that?
Who wants to talk about? I mean, shaming is deep in our culture. I don't personally think it's possible to be a parent without using it occasionally.
We're running two things together. One, it seems to me, I don't deny they run into one another. But one is, let's say, arguing that we have, from the pulpit, let's say, that we have done something shameful. Now, I don't think of that as necessarily a shame. I mean, the direction of attention is on getting people to morally to understand the significance of what they've done. And if, as a matter of fact, I actually think that shame is not just an emotion, it's a way of actually apprehending something. It's a way of coming to understand the significance of what one has done. I don't think of that as shaming in the sense in which I was objecting to it. And indeed, I agree with Catherine. It's very, very important that we feel, that we recognise through our shame the significance of what we've done in certain contexts. Mm. And sometimes it requires other people to show us, obviously. Mm. I just don't trust its institutionalisation.
Anyone else? Okay, thank you. Next one.
Someone I can't recall now once wrote that you can't hate someone for their own good, so maybe we can adapt this to you can't shame someone for their own good, but perhaps you can shame them for the betterment of others. So, for example, well, for the Centrelink thing, you can't shame an unemployed person for their own good, but you could shame the structures that keep them in that position, or for overweight people who can't buy clothes or fashionable clothes because they're not seen as being part of the correct norm. You can shame the industries rather than the people for being fat. And the most pressing example I can think of that recently is that of Claire and Matthew Johns and all their rugby boys, that much of the public reaction to Claire was that she was a slut and that she should have known better and that she shouldn't have been in that position. And obviously that's not true and it's not going to achieve anything, but Johns and all of his friends were excused because of the place that they occupy in Australian culture. And I think that we should be able to shame their behaviour, not just because it's reprehensible, but because of this celebration that they enjoy and will continue to enjoy in spite of what they've done, and that they're defended because of this place and culture. So if we can outstrip celebration with shame, surely we can have some part in changing this kind of culture that exists within rugby or within unemployed people or within fashion. Think about that.
So this is sort of this is a version of the idea of killing a deserter pour encourager les autres, shame someone to encourage the others to be better. Yeah, who wants to go at this?
I'll have a brief go at it, but it was interesting around the Matthew Johns thing because there was an attempt to shame the other players who had been involved in those incidents to come forward. And in fact, I think that was a worthy attempt, but I'm not surprised that it failed because there's such a closing of ranks around in some particular sort of cultural groups within Australian society, and well-paid, very prominent football players are a group that is well-protected and a group that closes ranks and a group that doesn't and that has a very, very strong internal code that you don't dob in your mates and you don't tell things, you don't talk about things publicly if they can be dealt with in-house. So that kind of closing of the ranks prevented the shaming from producing confessions from other people who'd been involved in essentially what were alleged to be criminal acts. And that is one of the difficulties, I suppose, when you try. That's another example of the unshameable, that no matter how horrendous the crime and no matter how awful the circumstances that people allege to have taken place, that group of football players closed ranks and was unable to be shamed. I was actually, at the time, I remember being a little bit impressed with the attempts to get them to break ranks. It seemed to me that after the culmination of years of scandal around football players and their behaviour towards women, that maybe we finally had a scandal that was big enough that was going to allow some of those strictures to fall away, and it didn't happen. It didn't happen.
This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2009 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Barsmith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.